We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
Well, a man called Jacques Monod won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1965 in cellular biochemistry and was the director of the Pasteur Institute in Paris. In 1970, he produced this book, which I purchased for $4.95 in hardback, secondhand, and it's called Chance and Necessity. The English translation, of course, 1972, if I remember. And the phrase chance and necessity comes, as his preface page puts it, from Democritus, the 5th century Greek philosopher, who was one of the earliest examples of atheism and who had the same kind of ethical systems as the Epicureans, who came later, and the utilitarians of the British Enlightenment. Democritus said, everything existing in the universe is the fruit of chance and necessity. Everything existing in the universe, you, me, the overhead, the page this is written on, is the fruit of chance and necessity. And from Monod's work, elucidating the replication of mechanisms of genetic material in the manner in which cells synthesize protein, which, as you can understand, I've just read. From that kind of work, he'd come to his conclusion that the whole universe is just matter over an infinite amount of time and chance. That by chance, given enough examples of things bouncing around ultimately, this could happen. And once the chance takes off, once the molecule is made and starts to replicate, then it just goes on replicating and on, and there develops a necessity out of it which evolves into you and into me, so that the whole universe is one magnificent, complex accident. Take, for example, his last paragraph, when he launches into ethics at the end. He said, this is perhaps a utopia, the dream he has, which is not really, because utopia is much more sensible. But this is perhaps a utopia, but it's not an incoherent dream. It is an idea that owes its strength to its logical coherence alone. It is the conclusion to which the search for authenticity necessarily leads. The ancient covenant is in pieces. Man at last knows that he is alone in the unfeeling immensity of the universe, out of which he emerged only by chance. Towards the end of this fairly standard piece, really, of atheistic cosmology and atheistic evolutionary thinking, this kind of accidentalism as a theory, he produces his chapter on ethics. From the study of matter, his materialist assumptions reach his materialistic conclusions. But the trouble is that he really can't live with life as an accident. He wants it to be ethical. And so he gives us this ethical chapter at the end, which undoes all his work. Because when you read his ethics, the ethics of knowledge, as he calls it, it demonstrates that he should have stuck to biochemistry. He just falls into the usual naturalistic fallacy that moves from what is to what should be, what ought be. This is an overhead, therefore I ought. There's no conclusion from that, isn't it? This is an overhead, therefore this is an overhead. You can't move this is an overhead, therefore I should sit up all night and watch the wars score their centuries. There is no logical consequence of a moral ought character that comes from the way the world is. The way the world is the way the world is the way the world is. And if we're here because we're here because we're here because we're here, well then, the consequence of that is we're here. There is no, therefore we ought, therefore we should. You can't move from accident to meaning, for the very nature of accident is meaningless. And if we are here just as a matter of time and chance, and the kind of chance that necessitates us, well then, that's where we are, in a meaningless universe, living a meaningless life. That's the truth. But the truth doesn't matter. Ecclesiastes 9 looks fairly at a different point, but with the same kind of pessimistic mood of meaninglessness, and yet the same kind of ambiguity that yet in living this life there are values. But Ecclesiastes has the recognition that the values don't work. He looks fairly in chapter 9 at death. Death as a universal finality, and concludes that if death is the finality of us all, then life under the sun is meaningless. Verse 3 captures it. This is the evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes all. That is, you kill somebody and you'll suffer the death penalty. You murder babies and you'll suffer the death penalty. You steal and you suffer the death penalty for that too. You drive drunkenly and recklessly, well, you suffer the death penalty for that. You drive too fast, well, there's the death penalty for that. You drive within the law, there's the death penalty for that. You park your car, there's the death penalty for that. You don't drive at all, there's the death penalty for that too. You help little old ladies across the street, death penalty for that. You're kind to everybody, death penalty for that. You're born, death penalty for that. It doesn't matter what you do, you get exactly the same penalty, death. It kind of takes the edge off wanting to do anything, doesn't it? Certainly anything that might involve a tad inconvenience. I mean, if you knew you were going to fail, irrespective of how many lectures you went to, labs you did, how many tutorials you went to, how many essays you wrote, if you knew you were going to fail, irrespective of anything, just by enrolling, you were going to fail, what difference would it make to your life? Not much, I think, for some of us. Don't do that much anyway, do we? It kind of makes the whole point of the exercise pointless and stupid. But that's what he's saying in verse 2. All share a common destiny, the righteous, the wicked, the good, the bad, the clean, the unclean, those who offer sacrifices, those who don't. As it is with the good man, so it is with the sinner. As it is with those who take oaths, so it is with those who are afraid to take. It doesn't matter what you do. The undertaker comes out on top at every burial. But verse 3 adds another insight in the second half of the verse. The hearts of men, moreover, are full of evil, and there is madness in their hearts while they live, and afterwards they join the dead. This is going to be taken up more in chapter 10, and so later in this morning, in today's study. But the human heart is both evil and mad. And so even the way in which we live is not good. The end of it is death, but the progress of it's not so crash hot either, as we'll see in a little while when we come and look at wisdom and folly. But if finality is the end, which it must be tautologically, if death is the end, I mean, if that's the finality, well then we may as well enjoy it. In a meaningless world, finality means fun. May as well make up that meaning as any other. That's the meaning Democritus made up, that's the meaning the Epicureans had, that is the meaning of the utilitarians, that's the meaning of the pragmatists, that's the meaning anybody who's got any life left in them, unlike Mr. Monod, who wants us to not so much enjoy ourselves as to think. Which for some people is fun, I presume him. And if the finality is fun, well then that's means fun, then that's what verses 4 through to 10 are about. I mean, if you're going to try to be wise about meaninglessness, you may as well live. For even you can work out that a live dog is better than a dead lion. Life is better than death. Verse 4, because when you're alive, you've still got hope. When you're dead, you've even lost your hope. I mean, as long as you're alive, something might turn up that gives meaning and purpose to it all. Somebody might find the way of avoiding death. I mean, there might be something going there. So you've got hope. When you're dead, well, there's no hope then. And when you're alive, you know things. But when you're dead, you don't know anything. Although one ponders how he knows that you don't know, seeing he's not there himself. But they have no further reward. They don't even have memory. And no one remembers them either. Their memory's gone. Their passions are gone too. Passions are only for life. Love, jealousy, it's all gone. You're not part of anything once you're dead, so it's better to be alive. Now, if it's better to be alive than to be dead, well then, Robert Herrick, gather ye rosebuds while you may. Old time is still a-flying. And this same flower that smiles today, tomorrow will be dying. I mean, live. If the only thing you've got is life, then live. What else can you do but live and live to the full? So verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. You may as well. That's the only chance. You only get one chance at this life. You may as well live it to the full. Eat, drink, be merry, always clothed in white, which kind of bombs the orange people and the Gothics out, doesn't it? Really? He's saying enjoy, anoint your head with oil, in other words, wash your face, do your hair, get out and enjoy life with your wife whom you love. Very old worldly view, isn't it? But friends, don't think that as you live life to the full, that life is going to turn out to the good because you live it to the full. Don't think that your actions now will somehow determine anything in the future. Do not think that the outcome will depend upon your effort, because verse 11, the race is not to the swift, nor is the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favour to the learned. That's not how life is determined. Life is determined, end of verse 11, by time and chance. That's how life's determined. And it happens to us all. You see, we want to think, well, if I run faster, then I'll win. If I get better educated, then I'll climb the ladder. If I work harder and longer, then I'll get the promotion. But in the end, the governing, determining factor of the outcome is time and chance, not your effort. Moreover, no man knows when his hour will come. As fish are caught in a cruel net, or birds are taken in a snare, so men are trapped by evil times. He might be the fastest swimming fish in the school, but if the net is down in the bay where his school is swimming, well, he'll get caught up just like the rest. It makes no difference whether you're the fastest or the slowest, whether you're the fattest or the thinnest. It really is not going to make any consequence at all, one way or another. Enjoy the trip, because the destination is the grave. The destination is going to be identical. And even the nature of how enjoyable the trip is out of your control. So just do what you do. That's really all it is. You think back to the brilliant young men and women who died in World War I. I was at Bathurst the other day, and there, like every country town, and even Little Hartley, I noticed it too, which is not even a town anymore. In every country town in New South Wales, in the middle of the town, there is the obelisk to the First World War. And there is the list of all these young men and some women who died in their youth, one after another. It was evil times. Just like they are today, to be killed in Rwanda. Just like the many of our generation of, I suppose, your grandparents, my parents, who were denied education in the Depression. It had nothing to do with the fact that they were as clever as we were. They just happened to be born at the wrong time, in the wrong place. The reason that I am and you are educated and healthy has very little to do with what you've done and what I've done. It's got to do with having been born in the right place or the right kind of middle-class families that pushed us along in a moment in history when education was fairly freely available to the kinds of people that we are. It has to do with how well our mother and father shoved us along and taught us and spoke to us and encouraged us. It has very little. It has to do with our genes. It has to do with all kinds of things, but very, very little is the outcome determined by us. It's a foolishness. It's got to do with deserving to treat yourself. You notice the number of advertisements that talk about treating yourself. You deserve it. Because when you're eating something fattening, then it's kind of nice to know that you deserve it, isn't it? That kind of justifies the experience of what you know is stupid. And so go and take your overseas trip. You deserve it. And we want to think that our activities determine our outcomes, but they don't. The race is not to the swift. It's all the outcome of time and chance, which we don't like thinking about. That is the truth. So living in an immoral kind of world, immoral because the finality of death is the same for everybody, living in an immoral time, or living in times where just the fortune of fickle fate, of time and chance, determines the outcome of everything we do, and therefore what we do doesn't matter, then what value is there in wisdom? And what foolishness there is in folly? So chapter 9, verse 13, I also saw under the tree this example of wisdom that greatly impressed me. There was once a small city with only a few people in it. And a powerful king came against it, surrounded it, and built huge siege works against it. Now there lived in that city a man poor but wise, and he saved the city by his wisdom. But nobody remembered that poor man. So I said, wisdom is better than strength. I may not know absolutes, but I can see relatives. That is, I can see being alive being better than being dead. I can see being wise is actually more powerful than to be strong. Wisdom is better than strength. There's an example of values. A story was told to me some time ago, and I cannot now remember who it was about, and worse still, whether it was told to me as a true story or as a false story. I don't know if it's a fable, fiction, that just has a moral to it, or whether it actually happened in history. And anybody like to share with me later and tell me about this kind of urban myth that's running around in my head and its background, I'd like to hear. I actually rang up the man who told it to me, but just got his answering machine, so I can't check it out now. But a story of a besieged, starving city that was really reduced down to towards the end of its food. And the people were crying out for hunger, and the last animal to be slaughtered came. But instead of slaughtering the animal and sharing around the meagre rations to everybody, or give the king a lot, or give the soldiers who are fighting hardest a lot or something, they decided to throw the animal over the side of the wall out to the besieging army. And throwing the animal over, yelled out taunts to them, saying, come on, haven't you got enough food out there? Here's some of ours, share it with us. And the army outside, seeing that they still had so much food, decided that they couldn't starve them out and retreated and went home. It's a great fable, but if someone knows it's true, I'd love to hear about it. I'd speak with even greater vigour on the subject. Wisdom can be stronger than strength. There can be the occasion when the wise decision actually outflanks the strong decision, can't there? So wisdom has great value. Verses 17, 18, the quiet words of the wise are more to be heeded than the shouts of the ruler of fools. And wisdom is better than weapons of war. But one sinner destroys much good. Wisdom is better. But you notice the end of verse 18, it actually introduces another problem though, that is, wisdom though is vulnerable. Wisdom is not absolutely better. It is not the all-powerful. Because one sinner destroys much that's good. See, as we see wisdom's value, we've got to see its vulnerability. For what happens to that poor wise man who saved the city back there in chapter 15? Well, verse 16, "So I said, wisdom is better than strength, but the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are no longer heeded." Oh, at the moment he may save the city, but later on, who can remember him? And who will remember him? Politicians always jump in the limelight and take credit for any victory. And so, chapter 10, verse 1, "As dead flies give perfume a bad smell, so a little folly outweighs wisdom and honour." Folly is more powerful than wisdom. Now that's sad news, isn't it? This is very sad news. To know that the vulnerability of wisdom means that both the outcomes can't be controlled by wisdom, and the outcomes are more likely to be controlled by folly, by madness. This may be the point of chapter 10, verses 8 to 11. There are some difficult verses in this passage. If you look across to chapter 10, verses 8 to 11, I know we haven't read yet, but we'll read it there. "Whoever digs a pit may fall into it. Whoever breaks through a wall may be bitten by a snake. Whoever quarries stones may be injured by them. Whoever splits logs may be endangered by them. If the axe is dull and its edge unsharpened, more strength is needed. But skill will bring success. If a snake bites before it is charmed, then there is no profit for the charmer." I reckon. It could be at this point that they're saying, well, we don't know the outcome of anything. And so wisdom really is of no value. You dig a pit, but who knows, you might be the person who falls into it. You break through a wall, but who knows, it could be a snake on the other side to bite you. Wisdom is not wise enough to know the outcome, and therefore... Or on the other hand, it could be illustrations of the folly of folly. That the foolish man doesn't look ahead, and so digs a pit and forgets that he can fall into it. Goes through walls and forgets that there could be snakes on the other side. Dulls his axe and thinks he's going to get further by just hitting harder. For much of chapter 10 is about the folly of folly. For foolishness has disproportionate influence, chapter 10, verse 1. Just a few dead flies can turn the whole perfume off. I don't know about the truth of this. I've never experimented either with perfume or dead flies. But you see the point. A little bit of it can overwhelm even what is good. And it's easy, you see, in our foolishness to tear down. It's easy in our foolishness to destroy things. It takes a long time to build things. Look at those war pictures that come from Lebanon, from what used to be called Yugoslavia. Look at the demolition that has taken place in just a few weeks of buildings destroyed by the warfare. And think how long it takes to rebuild. To rebuild just the buildings, to say nothing of the rebuilding of the shattered lives, to say nothing of the rebuilding of a shattered society. It's easy in our mad fury to destroy, but it's hard to build. Folly has a disproportionate influence and is perverse in its way. Chapter 10, verse 2 is the verse that all right-wingers should read to their left-wing friends. "The heart of the wise inclines to the right, but the heart of the fool to the left." First day I discovered that verse, I rang up one of my Socialist Labour Party men friends and just told him over his answering machine that I had a verse specially for him, Ecclesiastes 10:2. Should have heard the phone call I got back. Well, you shouldn't have heard the phone call I got back. What it's saying is, the perversity of human nature, which those of you who are right-wingers would immediately say, yes, that's right, perversity of human nature. Now it's saying the fool will choose to do the alternative for no other reason than because he wants to do the alternative. That's the character of foolishness, isn't it? We're just doing a family series on Sunday morning church, and I was a bit worried about doing it on the family because I know there's lots of fractured families and there are lots of people who think church people only ever go on about families and don't do anything but make them feel guiltier and worse. And there's a man who's recently been converted who's coming to our church on and off, and so I knew his family life was complete chaos, and I knew if he turned up to hear us preaching on the family, he'd kind of just get up and walk out the door immediately. So I carefully rang up one of my friends who was his close friend and suggested that maybe he should talk to him, tell him that it's about the family and not to balk and not to freak, and we're going to say some things that will be actually helpful to people whose lives are fractured rather than just be making them feel more guilty. He's a foolish man. As soon as he heard my friend mention church, he didn't listen to anything else that was said. He just assumed he was being nagged about having to come. And so he made it a very important point that he wouldn't come. And that's the perversity of a foolish person, isn't it? He might be 45, but he's still acting like a 15-year-old. It's the perversity. Say go to the right, no, I'll go to the left then. Can't. That's the character of it. And you see it over and over again. See the stupidity of the civil libertarians using all their intellectual weight and their legal prowess to defend pornography? I mean, garbage is garbage. You don't need lots of university degrees to work out the smell. While at the same time, political censorship is alive and well and running the country. The real issues, they don't often tackle the stupid ones. And so, I mean, these ridiculous ads that are being put up around the streets at the moment. A student history tute the other day was telling me, after the tute, was telling me how members of the tute were trying to say, well, not trying to say, they were saying it adamantly, that alcoholic abuse had nothing to do with poor people being poor, had nothing to do with fracturing families. And that's just perverse. That's just nuts. That's just the kind of rambling adolescent stupidity of somebody who's never had to go around and pick up the people on the streets and seen the devastating consequence of alcoholic abuse in our society. But it sounds good in the history tutor, so keep saying. Perversity. Now, folly, you see, eventually becomes public. You can fool some of the people, all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but not all the people all the time. Who said it? Abraham Lincoln it's attributed to, but it's also equally attributed to Phineas Barnum, the man famous for that other great quote, "There's a sucker born every minute." In the end, folly will oust, though. That's what chapter 10, verse 3. See, even as he walks along the road, the fool lacks sense and shows everyone how stupid he is. In the end, you can't fool all the people all the time. Everybody sees it ultimately. But folly creates disaster. It could be the disaster of chapter 8, verses 8 to 11. Or it could be the kind of disaster that you see in verse 12 following. Words from a wise man's mouth are gracious, but a fool is consumed by his own lips. At the beginning his words are folly, at the end they are wicked madness, and the fool multiplies words. No one knows what's coming. Who can tell him what will happen after him? A fool's work wearies him. He doesn't know the way to town. It's a famous line, isn't it? You don't know the way to town? Woe to you, O land, whose king is a servant and whose princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, whose king is of noble birth and whose princes eat at a proper time, for strength, not for drunkenness. The foolishness has terrible social consequences on everybody else. It creates disaster for all. It's the bad news of the fools. They talk nonsense and they create madness around the place. They don't even know the way to town. It's a way of saying they don't know anything. They can't fight their way out of a paper bag. They don't know how to work hard. Verse 18, if a man's lazy, the rafters sag. If his hands are idle, the house leaks. I mean, they haven't got enough puff to climb up an escalator. They don't think, they can't see what is going to happen. You see, verses 8 to 11 fits in with verse 17 there and 18 there, and it couldn't be the idea that the fool, they don't know the outcome of anything, verse 14. And they go on talking as if they do know, and they encourage people to do things which are stupid. And it's worse still when they're in power, when they're the princes. A king who's a fool running the country is a pain to everybody. His young sons will get up in the morning in order to drink, in order to feast, in order to be drunk. The folly in power is a great evil. It's all through this chapter. Verse 5, back to verse 5. There is an evil I've seen under the sun, a sort of error that arises from a ruler. Fools are put in many high positions, which the rich occupy, while the rich occupy the low ones. I've seen slaves on horseback, while princes go on foot like slaves. Our kind of democratic way of thinking doesn't really appreciate what is being said there in verse 7 and the like. But the slave on the horseback was the greatest pain in the ancient world. A man who knew absolutely nothing and was a complete idiot who would rule the country and would rule it. You see it actually, and I'm sorry to say it, is often the case that some of the worst tyrannical governments that we've seen have come from corporals like Hitler and little men like Stalin and Idi Amin and the like. When you move to totalitarian power, the little man, the little pumped-up dictator, is one of the worst of all people. His foolishness, his arrogance, his power that he exercises. Folly in power is dreadful. It's bad enough when a man is a fool and creates his own disaster, but when the whole country is in the hands of fools, how great is the disaster? So what's the wise courses of actions? For throughout chapter 10 and into chapter 11, verses 1 to 6, where we're finishing, by the way, we're not going to finish at verse 16 in chapter 11, for fairly obvious reasons, if you look for it. Verse 6 is where we're going to finish. The heading at the top under time and chance is just one of my errors, not my secretary's, mine. What are the wise courses of action through chapter 10 and into chapter 11? For throughout the chapter, it's contrasted with folly, the wise course of action. And it has much to do with politics, the politics of life, not just the politics of Canberra, the boardroom, the coffee room, the family, the neighbourhood, the flat, the household, your parents and your brothers and sisters, the sporting club, the staff room, wherever you're in society. First thing, chapter 10, verse 4, stay calm. That's a wise action. If a ruler's anger rises against you, don't leave your post. Calmness can lay great errors to rest. There's a piece of wisdom for you. It's the wise person. Chapter 10, verse 12, the wise person speaks graciously. Chapter 10, verse 17, the person of noble birth whose children eat at the right time, not getting drunk in the morning, and they eat for the right reason, that is to be strong. There's wisdom. Or chapter 10, verses 19 and 20, a feast is made for laughter and wine makes life merry, but money is the answer for everything. Isn't that an extraordinary verse? Do not revile the king, even in your thoughts, or... First thing, chapter 10, verse 4, stay calm. That's a wise action. If a ruler's anger rises against you, don't leave your post. Calmness can lay great errors to rest. There's a piece of wisdom for you. It's a wise person. Chapter 10, verse 12, the wise person speaks graciously. Chapter 10, verse 17, the person of noble birth whose children eat at the right time, not getting drunk in the morning, and they eat for the right reason, that is to be strong. There's wisdom. Or chapter 10, verses 19 and 20, a feast is made for laughter and wine makes life merry, but money is the answer for everything. Isn't that an extraordinary verse? Do not revile the king, even in your thoughts, or curse the rich in your bedroom, because a bird of the air may carry your words and a bird on the wing may report what you say. Well, yeah, the wise person understands that feasting and wine are for specific limited value, whereas money is usable in all kinds of situations. That's just wisdom that you can... And he learns discretion. Even in private conversations, when the boss is against you, don't go around blabbing. Don't think that you can say private, secret things. There is no privacy. Canberra is a sieve. It leaks all the time, doesn't it? Nothing anybody says anywhere is private, and you've just got to understand that. You can never be sure when you're being listened to. But, given you don't know the outcome of the actions, that they can lead to disaster, like in chapter 10, verses 8 to 11, should the wise person do nothing? Is that the wise course of action? Always stay calm. When the king's angry or not, just stay calm. Don't say anything. Don't move. Keep your mouth shut. Keep your head down. It'll all pass over sometime like the ostrich. No, chapter 10, verse 18 tells you if you don't do anything, the house will fall down around about you. You've got to take action. So chapter 11, cast your bread on the waters. And after many days, you'll find it again. Give portions to seven, yes, to eight. For you do not know what disaster may come upon the land. No, take action. Cast your bread upon the waters, a very famous line of a previous generation would use often, which means have a go. You can't win a race unless you're in it. Have a go, is what is being said. It's hard to know precisely the imagery of cast your bread upon the waters. It could be referring to trade. If that is the case, it's send your bread out on the waters in the trading world in order to gain return after a long period of time. If that is the case, then verse 2 is saying, but don't put all your eggs in the same basket. That's it, our kind of proverbial statement, right? That is, give portions to seven to eight. Send it out in eight different boats, not just all on one boat, or you might lose the lot. That's what it could mean. Or alternatively, it could refer to generosity. Cast your bread on the waters, give generously. give generously, and to whoever asks, seven people, eight people, whoever asks, because you never know when the bad times are coming for you and you'll get it back in due time. The point is the same. Have a go. Don't sit still. Don't hold back. Don't keep to yourself. Have a go. And so verses 3 to 6 follows the same kind of line. If the clouds are full of water, they pour rain upon the earth, and whether a tree falls to the south or to the north in a place where it falls, there it'll lie. Whoever watches the wind will not plant. Whoever looks at the clouds will not reap. As you do not know the path of the wind or how the body is formed in a mother's womb, so you cannot understand the work of God, the maker of all things. Sow your seed in the morning, and at evening let not your hands be idle, for you do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will equally do well. You don't know whether it's going to rain or not at harvest time. So when you get up, don't stand there and say, I don't think I'll go out harvesting because the clouds are there. I'll just wait and see if it rains. Because at the end of the day, you'll still be waiting to see if it rains and you haven't harvested anything. Get out there while you can. Don't say, well, I'm not going to go out sowing today. The wind's a bit strong, or it might be. Go out, sow, cast your seed in the ground. It's the only chance you've got of getting a crop. You don't know the outcome. Who knows whether it mightn't turn out well? So have a go. So we live in the times and seasons. We live in chance and opportunity. That's the world we're in. We're not living in the world in which we control, even by our wisdom. And so the wise thing to do is to have a go. The wise thing to do, seeing you don't know, you can't control, you can't even predict, is to cast your bread on the waters. Whatever your hand finds, do it. Do it with all your might. Chapter 9, verse 10. Life is for living, and the wise will make the most of it, even when they live at the mercy and whim of time and chance. And so in making the most of it, you may be killed or maimed. But wisdom will not win in the affairs of people, for folly outweighs wisdom. Chapter 10, verse 1. You see, it's just more powerful than wisdom. And evil and madness is in the heart of man. Helen Garner has just produced this incredible book about the sexual abuse case down in Melbourne, and she was being interviewed the other day in a book reading, after a book reading, and she says this in front of a great crowd of people, and I don't know what she believes Christianly or not Christianly, I've got no idea. This is not written as a Christian, but as a feminist, as she calls herself, which may be Christian, may not be. With this whole business of men and women, you can make change to the law, but you cannot change the things that happen in people's hearts. Things are better now in some ways, but in some deeper parts, there will always be a struggle with the opposite sex. There are large amounts of people's beings that can never be legislated, which is why women will never be safe, never be at peace with the opposite sex. It's a hopeless hope, and I don't even think it's a bad thing. There is an interesting statement, isn't it? For she has understood that the problem actually lies in the hearts of people. And she's right. The heart of people, not just men, is mad and evil. And therefore folly is going to win, because folly is more powerful than wisdom. That's the character of the world you're in. So have a go, but you're going to lose. Be a West Indian batsman. Play your natural game, but you've got 2 days in which to face a deficit of hundreds of runs. Not that I'm pleased. So wisdom won't win. But notice, the whole discourse has been conducted with no resurrection. Death is the end. Verse 5, the living know, the dead don't. Verse 6, the passions are dead. Chapter 9, verse 9, the grave has no work, no planning, no knowledge, no wisdom. And therefore, while we live, eat, drink and be merry. While we live, work and enjoy your life. While we live, be wise and take your chances. Know when to shut up before rulers and know when to speak graciously. But all the time, folly and madness will rule and life is meaningless. But what if somebody should rise from the dead? What if life does not end with death? What if there is judgment beyond the grave? What if the evil are punished? Well, then the whole life changes its meaning. Then the whole of life will find meaning. then morality will matter, then madness and evil will not win, then my mind's meaning will turn out to be meaningful. And so 2 weeks ago we celebrated not just the rising of one man from the tomb in first century Palestine, but also the rising of all people, for he was the beginning of the judgment of God. And that's why it's so important for those of you who have laboured through the meaninglessness of the 10 chapters of Ecclesiastes to make it to the final study in chapter 12, 11 and 12, where we come to the finality of Ecclesiastes and the final and only positive study that is there in all these weeks, when we come to the unlikely study called The Pleasure of Punishment. But that's next week, so let's pray, shall we? We thank and praise you, Heavenly Father, that you sent your Son into this world and that he died our death, but especially that he rose to new life to show us your judgment and to bring it about, that we would not live in a meaningless and futile existence, the captives of time and chance and the victims of evil, folly and madness, but that we can live in a world of meaning and value, of truth and of love, and of justice and integrity. We praise you for your Son who died for us and rose again, and we praise you in his name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.